then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man his chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's July the 18th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Hi, guys. Okay, things on the show may be a bit discombobulated this week. It's now Tuesday morning, and I'm still waiting for some things to arrive in the email regarding material which I would like to have on here this week, but which, for one reason or another, I may not be able to get and edit up in time. Now, there's one project especially that I'm hoping to see some results on before tonight or early tomorrow morning, but I have no idea if that's going to happen. Now, it's possible that if this stuff comes in time, I may decide to upload the show on Thursday afternoon or evening, and I'd like to remind you once again that the official deadline for the show is every Thursday at 8 p.m. Pacific time. That's 11 p.m. Eastern time. So in actual practice, I'm usually over 24 hours early, but technically speaking, we're not late until 8 p.m. Thursday, which is why the show has never been late in 3.5 years. Let's see. Do I do the Trayvon bit first or deal with some other stuff? Other stuff, I think. Now, guys, when you're submitting material to me that you would like to be on the show, what I need from you is an MP3 audio file or a link to where an MP3 audio file can be directly downloaded without me having to play any software games or sit down and puzzle through a help page that was originally written in Chinese and has been translated into English by a computer translating program. Do not just send me YouTube links and expect me to do all the ripping and editing and whatnot myself. I think I've told you this story before. Basically, I need people who do this a lot and who are experienced and up to date in getting around YouTube's security. YouTube basically doesn't want people ripping off the soundtracks to music videos lest we file share, which is horrible and wicked and sinful and deprives Jewish record companies of their well-earned royalties. YouTube is constantly deploying countermeasures to interdict the latest software that the hackers use to steal their audio content, and the hackers themselves are constantly coming up with new programs and tools to enable them to capture the files and get them onto their own hard drives and then throw away the stupid video images and get it all that lovely audio content and carry it off for free, like the internet used to be. It's a great game for all concerned, but I just don't have time to keep up with it all. Enough. We'll see if that stuff I'm waiting for gets here on time. Now, kind of tangentially on that subject, I'm not going to get too deeply into this topic because it sounds paranoid and weird. And for all I know, it may be paranoid and way off base, but I'm going to ask you guys a favor. Now, God knows the last thing I need is more email, but those of you who are regular personal or cyber contacts of mine, would you please make sure that you check in at fairly regular intervals just to let me know that you're still alive? No, I mean just that. Let me know that you're still alive. You will probably just get nothing but a monosyllabic grunt back from me in reply, but I'll really appreciate the gesture so I don't have to worry, and it's starting to look like there may be some reason for worry. Now, I do not want to start any kind of big sound and fury situation here, but I will be very blunt. A disturbing pattern seems to be developing. a pattern that is being observed by others besides myself, if the truth be known. White nationalist people are starting to disappear, or at least in a movement which exists 95% on the internet and which depends on the internet for communication between individuals and tiny cells of people, most of whom have never met. They seem to be disappearing, which is probably deceptive and doesn't mean anything, but there it is. Gone is gone, and when all you've got is the internet, in most cases not even a physical or mailing address for someone, or even a photograph, then when they disappear off the net, they disappear just as effectively as Judge Crater or Flight 19 in the Bermuda Triangle. I do not claim to know what is happening here. I am not suggesting that these people are being disappeared by the FBI or rendered to foreign prisons where they can be tortured, or that they are being administratively executed by the FBI and buried in the woods somewhere under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011, all of which would be perfectly legal, by the by, under the laws of Obama's America. I repeat, I'm not suggesting that. I don't know. I don't have any evidence one way or the other except that certain people are just gone. Most likely that is not happening, although it may happen in coming years as things in Obama's America get worse and worse. But I'm getting a lot of chatter under the counter from other movement personalities. Now, I won't use the term leaders because we don't have any leaders. Anyway, the buzz is that an awful lot of people are simply going dark with no explanation. It has happened to me in a few cases, and it's hard to notice at first. You hear regularly from someone for years. You get letters and donations and suggestions and responses to articles and whatnot. Then you get really busy, and all of a sudden you turn around and you realize that you haven't heard anything from someone for 6 months, 8 months, a year. And no, Wedgie, it's not because these people are paying attention to your goat-dancing sock puppets on stupid websites. Actually, nobody seems to be paying attention to those at all lately. Nobody's come running to me recently telling me all about it. No kidding. On the rare occasions when goat dancers are able to perturb anyone, I always get puzzled emails asking me about this and that. Did I really work as a masseuse in a Turkish bath, or did I really send poltergeists to haunt Michael Hoffman back in the 1990s, whatever the current horse hockey is? No, I know the signs of movement flakiness. Trust me on this, I do. God knows I ought to after 40 years. And I just never got that vibe off the comrades who have just plain gone dark and non-responsive. Now, it could be any number of things. They could be sick or in the hospital. They could be dead. They could be on the run from the bill collectors or their ex-wife's lawyers. That happens a lot in the movement. Although why they wouldn't at least answer their email to me over that, I have no idea. Or they just plain could have lost interest, even after a period of years. Now, people do sometimes. They just get tired of fighting and tired of never seeing any visible results after all this time. And of all the things that I truly do get, that's what I get the most. But almost always when that happens, there are certain signs, and usually these people will say something to me before they go. They don't just go dark and be never heard from again. Now, I'm not talking about these internuts and flakes who just cyber hang around for a few weeks or months and then wander off. I'm talking about actual comrades of many years standing whom I have met, who have driven or flown thousands of miles to see me, and who have demonstrated a lifelong commitment. And now all of a sudden they just go dark. Now, it's not just our Northwest Front people. Certain other movement personalities have gotten sufficiently worried about this to start talking about it. Now, if I had to construct a theory, I would say this. Our friends in the silk suits seem to be ratcheting up their number of visitations around the country, and these could be for the purpose of intimidation. Now, rather than go directly for people who might, by a very wild stretch of the imagination, be called leaders, although leaders of what, I have no idea, it could be that they're trying to choke off our support systems by cruising around the countryside and terrorizing individuals, like that poor slob down in Texas a few weeks ago whose yard that they dug up and whom they interrogated for 2 days about me and the Northwest Front and everything else under the sun. Then apparently they just lost interest and wandered away. Still, a visit like that leaves an impression. Okay, guys, I won't keep up with this, but two things. If you get visited after you have told them to get a warrant and then closed the door in their faces, which is what you will do, And I repeat, after you have physically closed the door so that they can't wheedle you or shout questions or engage you from the porch, then you need to call or email me and tell me that you've been visited. Secondly, guys, I know that time passes quickly when you're busy, but please, every few weeks or so, just take the time to drop me an email and say hi or whatever, just to let me know that you're still in the land of the living, okay? I've come to like a lot of you guys. Cyber contacts or not, I'd kind of hate to see you go down a black hole.
Good afternoon, comrades. This is something that came my way as part of some suggested topics for RFN. I've decided to read the blog post pretty much verbatim as the author presented it, with only minor edits to make it more listener-friendly, or insert editorial comments. Many will probably find it a touchy subject, but it is something that should be addressed, so here goes. Should a white nationalist be entertained by television? This is intended to be a warning to my folk in the white nationalist movement, but could easily be of use to all people concerned with protecting their consciousness. My first comment has nothing to do with the watching of television at all, but questions whether you can afford to waste the time that you are going to spend. I am certain there are other activities you could choose to participate in that would be more beneficial. Watching television is usually a very antisocial activity. Being a white nationalist should lead you to promoting your race, and doing so depends on you associating in a social way with folk of your kind. If you need activity other than working together, you could play cards or other games, at least something where you are fully conscious of your actions and surroundings. The first article about the dangers of television I encountered was from a Christian perspective, and therefore reflects the problem from the sin angle, so please keep that in mind as you listen. The following is lifted from the inplainsight.org website. Television programs are designed with the purpose of reprogramming your mind by breaking down your defenses so you will accept a lie as truth. Many of the anti-Christian and immoral precepts are bellowed forth in situation comedies. They get you to laugh, then they put forth their principles, and you have accepted their teachings without reservation. This is why much reprogramming is done through comedy. If homosexuality, lesbianism, or living together without benefit of marriage is portrayed, it is an attempt to retrain your thinking that these are just alternative lifestyles, claiming it is accepted by everyone else. Wrong! God doesn't accept it! The media is the puppet of a powerful group of international bankers, which of course we understand are the Jews. Their umbrella groups are the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, Order of Skull and Bones, etc. They are all pushing one world agenda on us, attempting to convince us that only a one world society will preserve us from war and famine, and the other world problems they create with a phone call. The one world agenda is as sinful today as it was back when God destroyed Satan's first attempt at Babel. Some consequences of being a teleholic. Loneliness. Staying home and watching TV isolates you from other people. God created us to be social creatures requiring human interaction. Loss of human contact will cause extreme loneliness. Depression. Excessive TV watching may cause depression because night after night you continually soak up the world's idea of what success and value is. We begin to believe our lives, when compared with those exciting ones we see on TV, are really valueless, and this type of thinking, when drilled into us daily, will lead to depression. Physical disease. Our bodies were made for motion, not to sit in one place for hours daily. Our muscles and the rest of our body needs exercise for proper fitness and clear minds. One can become obese because incessant TV watching leads to incessant eating. Fantasy lifestyle. This happens when we watch so much TV that we have trouble separating reality from fantasy. TV can cause us to live in an imaginary lifestyle, like believing illicit sex without consequences. Social drinking is mandatory. You must drive an expensive car, etc. An imitation of a TV lifestyle can ruin a life. Suicide. When a person believes they have no friends, no value, and that they do not measure up to the fantasy lifestyle they impose on themselves, they see no reason for living. They do not realize a satanic deception has taken place. If there was such a group as Telaholics Anonymous, their meetings would be more packed than Alcoholics Anonymous. Acceptance of anti-white principles. TV shows are not written with recognition of the differences between the races in mind. As we are bombarded daily with anti-white principles, we begin to accept the methods Hollywood teaches. You claim you do not accept anti-white principles. Then why do you watch the same anti-white shows each week? If you keep watching them, you are endorsing them and the principles they teach. Soon you could find yourself opposing your own race, and even rebuking those who bring truth, and this could sow discord among our brethren, and create confusion in people who are new to the movement. That's the end of this particular article. I'm definitely not trying to push a Christian agenda, but some of their arguments strike a chord in our worldview also. And yes, I admit, I did change the last paragraph from a Christian point of view to an anti-white one by substituting anti-white for Christian and making a few minor edits to help emphasize that point, but I certainly didn't change much. There's another interesting article at simpletoremember.com describing the harmful effects of television on children and how it leads to ADD, ADHD, obesity, sleep disorders, and other problems. The following is an excerpt from the AmazingDiscoveries.org website dealing with deception, media, television, the brain, and violence. Dr. Herbert Krugman, a brainwave researcher, has gone on record saying, "Television is a communication medium that effortlessly transmits huge quantities of information to the viewers not thought about at the time of exposure." Dr. Eric Pepper, another influential brainwave researcher and writer, once said, "The horror of television is that the information goes in, but we do not react to it. It goes right into our memory pool, and perhaps we react to it later, but we do not know what we are reacting to." When you watch television, you are training yourself not to react, and so later on, you're doing things without knowing why you're doing them or where they are coming from. Under the influence of television, the frontal lobe cannot function at its full capacity. The brain does record information. Sight, memory, and emotions are all functioning well. Nevertheless, the brain no longer critically analyzes the information. Terrible scenes can be depicted, but the viewer tends only to laugh or shrug them off. Normally, if those kinds of events happen in real life, the individual would be appalled. Even this is changing as people become more desensitized through exposure. Despite how you respond, whether by laughing, apathetically staring, averting the eyes in disgust, or 100 other ways, scenes are indelibly imprinted upon the mind. When you see a rerun, once it begins, you know you have seen it before. The memory is there, although the last time you saw it, your frontal lobe was not any more active than it is this time. From a personal perspective, I, as a white nationalist, do not welcome Jews, Negroes, or homosexuals into my home. When we watch television, that is exactly what we are doing. By watching, we passively accept programs that promote concepts and ideas we would find abhorrent if we were rationally debating them. I was recently exposed to a scene at the end of a lame movie where a white man had become married to a negress, something that is all too common these days in TV and movies. Anyone concerned with the cognitive abilities of their families and themselves, whether they are white nationalists or not, needs to rationally consider whether this form of entertainment is worth the risk. As a white nationalist, you need to consider whether you intend to be accepting the views of our sworn enemies. Maybe it's time we reconsider just how much TV we watch and how much it's holding us back from all we have the ability to be. Hail victory, comrades.
You know, one of the most pernicious myths in American history is this idea that the Irish immigrants of the 19th century fought only on the side of the Union. In actual fact, there were a number of Irish units in the Confederate Army, such as Kelly's Irish Brigade and McCausland's Raiders. Now, the state of Louisiana seceded from the Union and joined the Confederacy in January of 1861. Like many localities throughout the South, they raised local militia units to provide for local defense, including a company of Irish immigrants who were, of course, called the Hibernian Corps. Now, we don't know much about them except that they existed, and they fought when no one else would. For a variety of long-involved historical reasons I won't get into, there were almost no Confederate forces in the city itself 15 months later when a combined naval and army force under Commodore David Farragut and Union General Benjamin Butler attacked, and the city fathers decided to surrender without a fight, which some may consider pusillanimous, but in view of what the Americans later did to cities like Vicksburg and Charleston and Atlanta, I think we can safely say that the only reason we still have the French Quarter today is because of that surrender, just like the only reason we still have antebellum Savannah today is for the same reason. In any case, New Orleans ordered its home guard units to lay down their arms and disperse peacefully. But either through some screw-up of typical military incompetence, the Hibernians just didn't get the order to surrender, or else they recognized a tyrant's servants, whether they were wearing red coats or blue coats, and decided, hell with this, they weren't going to let these American dogs come into their homes and bite without a fight. Anyway, when Ben Butler, the one who later earned the nickname of the Beast, was marching his 5,000-man army down the road to occupy the city of New Orleans in what he thought was going to be a cakewalk, these scrappy Irishmen opened fire on their asses. Held them off for almost 6 hours, in fact, which really pissed Ben the Beast off. American soldiers don't like having their cakewalks interrupted by annoying resistance from the Aborigines. Anyway, a large number of Irishmen died defending the country of my birth, when, for whatever reason, those who were born there would not. May the 9th, 1862. Gura mila magat, lads. Divide mi dharma. This is David Kincaid.
You Irishmen and women, to draw near both young and old, a doleful lamentation now to you I will unfold. With me to Raya, Father Riddle, to Raya, Raya, Father Riddle, tonight, oh. 100 gallant Irishmen we are left for to deplore, whose bodies fell a victim upon fair Columbia's shore. With me to Raya, my Father Riddle, to Raya, Raya, Father Riddle, tonight, oh. It was at the siege of New Orleans upon the 9th of May, our countrymen they suffered sore upon that fatal day. With me to Raya, Father Riddle, to Raya, Raya, Father Riddle, tonight, oh. They were engaged by 5-1 when charged on with the steel, but Aronson still loudly cry, "We'll die before we'll yield." With me to Raya, my Father Riddle, to Raya, Raya, Father Riddle, tonight, oh. They were repulsed, they could not stand, exertion proved in vain. They strove to break the enemy's force and drive them from the plain. With me to Raya, Father Riddle, to Raya, Raya, Father Riddle, tonight, oh. But alas, their number it was too small, and it gave them no fair play. Not one of them did they escape upon that fatal day. With me to Raya, Fodderilda, to Raya, Raya, Fodderilda, to Nido. To see the streets that evening each heart would rend with pain. The human blood in rivers ran like any flood or stream. With me to Raya, Fodderilda, to Raya, Raya, Fodderilda, to Nido. Men's heads blown off their bodies, most dismal for to see. And wounded men did loudly cry with pain and agony. With me to Raya, Fodderilda, to Raya, Raya, Fodderilda, to Nido. Federals they did then advance and broke in through the town. They trampled dead and wounded men that lay upon the ground. With me to Raya, Fodderilda, to Raya, Raya, Fodderilda, to Nido. The wounded called for mercy, but none they did receive. They numbered them among the dead and threw them in the grave. With me to Raya, Fodderilda, to Raya, Raya, Fodderilda, to Nido. 300 killed and wounded that did lay in their grave. One half of them were Irishmen, far from their native shore. With me to Raya, Fodderilda, to Raya, Raya, Fodderilda, to Nido. Poor orphans now they may weep and cry and parents through the day. They let their lovely children go on to America. With me to Raya, Fodderilda, to Raya, Raya, Fodderilda, to Nido. Hear those doleful lines, do not neglect to toil and labor for a livelihood on the St. Patrick's side. With me to Raya, Fodderilda, to Raya, Raya, Fodderilda, to Nido. And I think upon our countrymen who left their native shore. Their friends may mourn for their loss, they'll never see them more. With me to Raya, Fodderilda, to Raya, Raya, Fodderilda, to Nido. Now to conclude with these few lines, with grief I'll say no more. You know it was through poverty they left their native shore. With me to Raya, Fodderilda, to Raya, Raya, Fodderilda, to Nido. They had no one to heal their wounds, may angels them surround. Before the throne of heaven, may they wear a brilliant crown. With me to Raya, my Fodderilda, to Raya, Raya, Fodderilda, to Nido.
Okay, I have a problem here. Now, there's a topic that I want to cover and a speech that I really want to play for you in its entirety on this episode of Radio Free Northwest. And that alone is going to run really long, so long that I'm going to have to give Gretchen the Librarian a miss this week, for which I apologize to Gretchen and to you listeners. And yes, Gretchen actually has quite a few fans on the show. But before I get into that, events have dictated that I absolutely must say something about the Trayvon Martin George Zimmerman trial and acquittal. People expect it of me. It's one of those cases where something racial has been buried in weeks of bullshit by the liberal news media, and where anything I have to say would be pretty much restating the obvious, but if I don't say something, I'm going to get all these emails about it. Hurl, why didn't you talk about Trayvon and Zimmerman and yuck it up over the acquittal? So let me hit a few of the high points. First off, you and I both know that George Zimmerman is not a white man. He is a half-Jewish, half-Inca mestizo. This was never about race except insofar as Zimmerman was trying to protect his Jewish father and his Peruvian mother's home and wealth from a thieving nigger, which he had every right to do, and yes, when you see a large mongoloid slinking around inside a gated community wearing a hoodie to disguise his face, then you have every right to assume that the shvugi is casing the place for a robbery or a carjacking or he's looking to sell drugs. All blacks are criminals if they can get away with it, and many times they're criminals when they can't get away with it because they're stupid and they get caught, and that's why all the niggers in prison. That is simply the reality in Obama's America, and everybody watching that stupid trial understands this perfectly, including the liberal jackasses who were ranting and raving in the media. They understand it perfectly, even if they don't dare to say it. But for the purpose of the liberal media feeding frenzy, which started 15 months ago when the incident occurred, Zimmerman has been promoted by the media to the status of honorary white man. A lot of what Rush Limbaugh calls the low-information voters, which is a code word for white dumbasses, have somehow come to accept Zimmerman as white, or something called a white Hispanic. Now, in actual fact, yes, there are white Hispanics in Spain itself and in Argentina and Chile and a few other places, but George Zimmerman ain't one of them. But the dumbasses of all races have been told by the media that he is, and the media feeding frenzy has proceeded as if he's white, and so that's where all this hanna-hanna comes from. In point of fact, the blacks are a lot sharper in this department than the white dumbasses are. They took one look at Zimmerman on the media, and they knew damned well who and what done plugged poor little Trayvon, which is why, since the acquittal, there have been a number of nigger gang attacks on lone beaners, wherein the said beaners got the crap kicked and beaten out of them while the niggers yelled, "This is for Trayvon." Now, this has happened so far in Baltimore, Los Angeles, and San Francisco that we know of, and probably a lot more than the media is allowing us to know. Hopefully, the Spics will start retaliating, and we'll gin up a little black-on-brown race war going here. If it makes anybody black or white feel any better, George Zimmerman is going to be rearrested and recharged with federal civil rights violations, just like the cops in the Rodney King case and just like the Greensboro men. This is going to be done by the nigger Attorney General Eric Holder, the same mongoloid who stated at the beginning of the present dictatorship that his department would not be investigating the voter intimidation in Pennsylvania by the Black Panthers or any other civil rights violations against white people. Now, don't ask me why the hell George Zimmerman doesn't get his taco-colored ass the hell out of this country and back down to Peru before Holder moves on it. Maybe that's what Holder's waiting for, to try and kick the can down the road. Now, I'm sure whatever allowance that his Jewish daddy is giving him, Zimmerman could live like a prince in Lima. The poor dumb bastard probably still doesn't understand what he's up against. Oh, screw this. I'm all Trayvoned out. I'm bored with the whole damn thing. It'd be different if Effie Sue Washington were still around doing her parodies, but whoever was doing those things seems to be one of those people I mentioned earlier who has mysteriously gone dark and disappeared. Now, the guy who does Effie Sue, for all we know, may be sitting in a Romanian castle dungeon right now with CIA electrodes taped on his sensitive body parts. It's not as if there's any mystery about what happened to that nigger dope addict in Florida or why the beaner plugged him. The little pudgy, weak-ass brown beaner plugged the 6'2", 220-pound black nigger football linebacker because the nigger was pounding his head through the pavement. Now let's give this another week and see if there's any interesting riots, and I promise you I'll gabble about Trayvon next time, okay? Okay, now, this next topic, I suppose, falls into the category of internal affairs. Now, most of those listening to this podcast are probably aware of the existence and activities of a young man named Matthew Heimbach out of Maryland. Now, about a year ago, Matt started garnering some system media publicity as the head of a small group of white students at the University of Maryland in Towson who wanted to form a white student union. He did a little demonstration across from the White House like we used to do back in the day. He got spat on by communist Jews the whole nine yards. Now, if you don't know who Matt Heimbach is, I will let him introduce himself in a bit here, but I suspect most of you at least have some idea. His significance is simple. He and his friends are actually young enough to where they do not need bifocals or canes or walkers, nor do they clip coupons or articles about prostate cancer out of the paper, nor do they get junk mailings from the AARP, so forth and so on. Now, the way this usually goes is that young white boys spend their teenaged years playing video games in their rooms. Then they spend their 20s playing video games in their college dorms and later on in their parents' basements. If my own son didn't live in Ireland, and if I had a basement, he'd be down there now at age 28, so I know whereof I speak. Usually, at about age 30 or so, white boys figure out that they can't deliver Domino's pizza all their lives, and they do tend to latch on to some kind of crummy job in a cubicle or an office somewhere. And if they're lucky, they can hold on to that for about a dozen years or so until they're, say, 42. Then they get fired or laid off so that the company can take on someone younger at half the salary. Most likely female and non-white, or possibly an illegal immigrant. The parents are usually dead or in a nursing home by then, and so the basement is most likely no longer available because the house has been sold to pay the elder care bills, or else foreclosed on, and having spent their entire lives with their snouts in the trough, the little white boys finally look up from the trough with their muzzles dripping from the last of the American slop that they'll ever slurp up, and they say in surprise, "Duh, what's going on here, Vern? I'm being screwed, Vern. Somebody been committing an act of sodomy on my alabaster body all my adult life. Now, who been doing that, Vern? I was supposed to have this wonderful American life where I snowboarded off Mount McKinley and made millions drawing comic books, and I drove around in a van with a hot chick solving mysteries just like on TV. Now, where the hell did my life go, Vern? That great life that America promised me on TV, where is it? Where the hell did all these niggers and Mexicans in the Walmart come from, Vern? Why don't nobody speak English anymore? Why can't I get me no job at age 42? And who the hell are all them funny little men with the hooked noses hiding behind the curtain, Vern? Yeah, I get a lot of contacts that are more or less that. White boys don't become bitter, angry, confused, destitute, broken, and devastated white men until they reach their mid-40s, and usually that's when we get them. When, however much the spirit moves, they simply are not able or in any kind of position to help us to do what has to be done. You can't storm any barricades when your joints are frozen with arthritis and you can't hardly see straight without your glasses. Now, anyway, Matt Heimbach is living proof that, through some inconceivable grace of God, the next generation of white kids is not totally unreachable. Matt Heimbach represents hope for us. And because he represents hope, he now has, wait for it, he now has goat dancers leaping and cavorting all about him, bleeding and trying to headbutt him back down. What? You didn't really think all this happy horseshit was just about me, did you? You guys need to go back to Radio Free Northwest for February 21st, 2013, and listen to that podcast again, where I commented at length on the goat dancing. Now, I'm sorry to say that my own movement mentor, the Reverend Bob Miles, pretty much called it. He said, "Harold, when the real thing finally comes along, these people will not recognize it when they see it, and when they do understand, they will do their level best to destroy it." Now, by the way, don't misunderstand this. I'm not appointing Matt Heimbach as my successor or anything like that. I've never even met the man, although we've exchanged a few emails, and once he realizes the effect his ever meeting with me, under any circumstances, will probably have on the rest of his life, as far as the movement and the dictatorship and their secret police goes, he may not want to meet me, ever. Now, that's up to him. But this young man really doesn't deserve what's being done to him right now on the internet by the usual suspects. Who are the same ones, by the by, same IP addresses looks like, who ook and eek and turn flips like an organ grinder's monkey whenever I show up on a blog someplace. He really doesn't deserve it. Basically, the goat dancers are just warming up. No accusations of jury, federal informery, buggery, or wizardry yet, although I can tell him from personal experience that's coming. But he's currently being excoriated on the internet for a photo that he had taken about 2 years ago, wearing his Confederate reenactor's uniform and hugging a grinning nigger. Now, I gather that this was taken at a time when Civil War reenacting was about as racial as Matt had gotten, about 2 years ago apparently, and it's obvious to me from the photo that he's just fooling around like kids do. Now, I've already emailed him, though, and I told him, I said, "Son, you do understand that we are not allowed to have a sense of humor. So you do understand that that stupid photograph is going to follow you for the rest of your life. It's going on your tombstone. 40 years from now, somebody is going to be throwing that photograph at you because we are not allowed to have a joke. and everything we say or do is always taken officially at face value, especially by the police and the courts. Amat has also been accused of some suspiciously conservative and Glenn Beckish neoconservative sounding comments on Jews and niggers, which, again, I think is his youthful inexperience talking. I suspect that he thinks that if he tosses in a few mild disclaimers to the effect that, well, I'm not really racist or anti-Semitic, he thinks then the Jews and the media will somehow cut him some slack. They won't, but I can't tell him that. Now, Matt has to learn for himself. I long ago learned that while I have 40 years of experience in doing this, for whatever reason, it's something that I cannot impart to others. Nobody's listening. Everybody who wants to help the 14 words has to go through my learning curve, apparently, which usually means that by the time they accumulate my experience, they've reached my age. Now, I don't know why this knowledge and experience isn't transferable. I just know that apparently it isn't. I've been trying for years, and it just goes in one ear and out the other. Now, if everybody has to repeat my learning curve, so be it, but at least Matt Heimbach is starting at the same age I did, which is almost unknown these days. Let's see what you think.
Our next speaker has made an incredible splash on our tiny little movement over the last bit, and I had the opportunity to spend time with him yesterday, and it was a great pleasure to me. Rarely in my lifetime have I been able to meet such an intelligent person. He was the founder of the Towson University White Students Union, and recently the founder of potentially something very important, a nationalist youth organization, TradyYouth.org, Traditional Youth, Matthew Heimbach.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me come out. You know, as they say, the definition of an expert is someone from over 500 miles away, so that's what kind of get me from Maryland to bring me here. But I enjoy being around everyone. The hospitality in Southern California has been phenomenal, and I appreciate you guys giving me the time to talk. My talk, I'm a little bit nervous, might be a little bit more to the right than some of our previous speakers, but I've thoroughly enjoyed everyone who came before me, and there's a lot of things I like to talk about in reference to those previous speeches. One of the questions that has been asked several times now is, where does the movement go from here? But let me tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Matthew Heimbach. I was born in Poolsville, Maryland. It's a small town that doesn't have a traffic light. And the reason I'm here, Tyler kind of did the introduction, I went from a small farm town all the way to the big city of Baltimore, and I got to see the joys of diversity. And as I was talking to some of the comrades earlier, for instance, I was late for work a couple weeks ago because one of my crackhead neighbors stabbed another one of my crackhead neighbors, and then the police paddy wagon had me blocked in. So that's the joy of living in Baltimore. That's not a rare occurrence, that's a rather common occurrence. So I got to see firsthand what diversity does to us, where my home state of Maryland, unfortunately, has been occupied by the third world invasion. And we recently passed a law which creates in-state tuition for illegal immigrants. So if anyone here from California wants to come to a Maryland school, enjoy paying twice the money. But if you sneak over the border and make it to Maryland, you get to pay the same rate as every other single Marylander. And that just strikes me as fundamentally unfair. And of course, we see the Black Student Union, which has a giant Black Panther painted on their wall, and a nice homage to Nelson Mandela. And I thought, well, that's a little interesting. And then I see the Hispanic organizations working with La Raza and Casa de Maryland, openly calling for more third world immigration, allowing Spanish to be also the language of the United States, and basically wanting to destroy white folks. And I kind of have a problem with that. And then you see all these different advocacy groups. There's not one for white people. So I went to the College Republicans, because as the left has always told us, the Republicans are the party of white people. So when I come in the first day, I say, hi, my name is Matthew Heimbach. I'm interested about the concerns of white people. And they said, there's the door. So I found out really quick that the College Republicans were not exactly supportive of really anything whatsoever. Tax cuts for multinational corporations, but not even the blue-collar working class, which every conservative right-wing movement has been based on. So I created an organization, well, a chapter of an organization called Youth for Western Civilization, in which we, by the end of the semester, or the end of the year, had been run off campus because our Jewish advisor, who was the only advisor we could find, did not like the fact that we wrote white pride all over campus. So, fast forward a year, then we created the White Student Union, because you know what, it gets to that point, you might as well just say what we're talking about, and Western civilization is white people. So, throughout the course of the year, we did a lot of great things. We did an affirmative action bake sale. We were able to organize on racial lines to advocate for white people. We actually got to face off against the communists in Washington, D.C. Some of you saw the video on May Day, which I got the joy of having a nice bag of urine thrown on me and getting punched in the face. But, to be fair, one of my buddies, Scott Terry, punched a Jewess and knocked her unconscious. So I'm going to consider that a wash for the day. So that's kind of who I am and where I'm coming from. The question is, where are we going? Because, you know, I'm a Marylander. We are below the Mason-Dixon line. We have a strong Southern tradition. Our state song, for instance, ends with the phrase, "Huzzah, she spurns the northern scum." So I'm not a Southern Californian. And I've always been a proud Southerner. That's one thing, where we have different regional identities. I'm sure there's people in this room who have different religious affiliations. You know, even in the South, for instance, I was at the League of the South Conference. I'm an active member of the Maryland League, which is an organization calling for secession of the Southern states. I roomed with a National Socialist who was also a folk religionist. And I myself am a devout Orthodox Christian. But there was one thing that kept us together and why we were able to have a great weekend. We care about the survival of our people. And one thing we all know is very simple. Fractures within our movement over the past several decades, either through agent provocateurs, our own egos, desire for money, or simply because there's too many chiefs and not enough Indians, our movement has been in a circular firing squad for so long. Oh, so you don't support this tiny policy point? Well, I'm going to go and spend all of my energy destroying you and your organization, and so on and so forth. That is what we see in currently the white nationalist movement. There is this continual infighting. Now, luckily, this has fallen away as some of the old guard who had tremendous egos, I respect them for everything they did coming before me, but a lot of that infighting seems to be dying away with the newer generation, and that inspires me. But where we're going from here, we can no longer be aiming towards reforming America, and that might seem controversial, but this system cannot be reformed, nor should we want to reform it. Because America, from our founding fathers onward, this was a system, let's just picture it, that our founding fathers basically were fighting over money. They didn't like paying taxes on tea. They didn't like paying just a tiny tidbit of the money back to the British Empire for the war that the colonial states started by violating treaties with France. And we'll get into that. But from the very beginning, as the prior speaker said, there's this big issue of the individual, where as Americans, we really haven't had a folk identity. It's always been this capitalist idea of going out and making something for ourselves. And I say, that is the fundamental problem. America is a proposition nation, and that proposition has failed. It believes in democracy, equality, egalitarianism, all of these things that are the exact opposite of what we need to have the survival of our race. So, the question of where I think American Freedom Party, formerly American Third Position, and all pro-white organizations need to go. Fundamentally, white separatism. The creation of white homelands is the only way we can ensure the existence of our people. And you know, that might seem antithetical. I mean, I'm sure there are people in this room who have fought under the federal flag, but we must realize this system cannot be reformed. We've talked about the access to media. We will never be able to get in to the good club. You know, no matter how many times we smile or try and work insidiously in the media, we're never going to get there. There's a level where us goy can never make it. In terms of political power, look at what happened. Oh, thank you. Look at David Duke in regards to political success. When David Duke was running for governor of Louisiana, he had the full support of the movement. Every dollar we could pump into it, actually, he had some prior great exposure with the media. He's well spoken. And what happens? He got outspent something like 15 or 20 to 1 from out of state donors. And then what happens? They find trumped up charges in which we've all seen the picture where David Duke got a tax refund for the year in question, but they still sent him to prison. So trying to have electoral success, the feds will always find a way to stop us from getting to that level because the empire is the problem. You look at politicians like Alabama Governor George Wallace, thinking back, if we can work within this system, when Governor Wallace was in charge, we had the police, the National Guard, Governor Wallace, all the people of Alabama supported him, and the people all across the South. Even when Governor Wallace ran for president in 68, Michigan, of all places, voted for him in the Democratic primary. So he had all the support he could possibly get on a grassroots level. But what happens? The federal government comes in with bayonets and tanks, they federalize the National Guard, and then they force this change upon us. We cannot reform this system. The game is stacked against us from the beginning. They are guaranteed working for our destruction. Why, for instance, if Republicans were the answer, then under George W. Bush, we controlled the Congress, we controlled the Supreme Court, and the presidency, then we would have secured the border. We would have done something to stop our racial suicide, but we didn't. Because for Republicans and the capitalists, they have more interest in bringing in low-skilled labor, which pads their bottom line, than they care about their actual fundamental base. The Democrats simply believe in this egalitarian Jacobin belief in egalitarianism and want to destroy us. So we can't work within those two political parties. And we've seen now, with David Duke, I think is the greatest example, with a political party trying to forge its way into the system, can't do it. Now, the importance of having a political party, like the American Freedom Party, is federal law in some regards still helps us. We're talking about breaking into the media. But under federal law, if we run campaign ads, they have to air them. That's one of the great things about still having a political party. So I don't say give up having a political party, because it provides us some legal protections and access to be able to kick our way into the mainstream. But the goal that we need to be working towards is not simply getting a seat at the table. Because one seat at a table of multiculturalism still leaves us without a voice, still leaves us without a destiny. If we truly want to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children, the only way we can do that is the creation of a white homeland. Now, when I say that at Republican events, that's when, like, the bricks start coming out, so I really appreciate the applause. But the thing that we need to look at also in regards to where, that's the classic question of where. Now, I would say there are four, and it might seem large, but there are four different movements that are currently working. I myself am a member of the League of the South, working towards secession of the Southern states, based, however, though, on the idea that a Southerner is white. We also have the Northwest Initiative that was, you know, it's the Butler Plan, led by people like Harold Covington, the PLEs that are out there. Then we also have Alaska, which the Alaskan Independence Party, if you think how much power they fundamentally have, where even Sarah Palin, when running for governor, had to appeal to the Alaska Independence Party to go to get their votes to become governor. She actually didn't address for their convention when she was running for governor. So Alaska is actually light years ahead of us in terms of a secessionist movement, and then, of course, in the Northeast, where it's not about, for instance, just putting a dot on the map and saying to Southerners, it's time to pick up and move to Montana. It's not saying to folks that you really have to give up your home, but we need to start moving into organic folk communities with the express purpose of white separatism, because we cannot work within this system, because the system is fundamentally stacked against us. And what we need to do with that is, for instance, so say the American Freedom Party, we ask, what are you fighting for? We're fighting for a white homeland. As Richard Spencer recently referred to it at the American Renaissance Conference, white Zionism. That might seem crazy, that term, but fundamentally think of it in terms of Zionism. 20 years before the creation of Israel, Zionism was almost a lunatic fringe idea amongst the Jewish community. But there was the vanguard who kept saying, the Jewish state, a homeland for the Jewish people, this is what we're working towards. And when the moment came for that to happen, they were there. They had created the myths, they had created the heroes, they had created the folk songs, they'd be able to create everything that was necessary to be able to create, out of nothing, a culture and create the Jewish state. And that's what we need to be working towards, where we need to be getting away from symbols like the American flag. This is the symbol of our occupation. This is the symbol of our genocide. This is the symbol of the nation that has already said they will use drones to drop missiles on political dissidents. Do any of us think, sitting in this room, we're not considered political dissidents? Exactly. Seeing those nodding heads, you fundamentally understand we are at war with this system. And if you think for 2 seconds that George W. Bush or Ronald Reagan would be friendlier to us than Barack Obama is, then you have not been reading your history.
Okay, we're running way long here, and I need to get the rest of this Matt Heimbach speech into the program. And I was going to give you a big, long speech about the Okie migrations of the 1930s and try and convince you that what we're trying to do here in the Northwest has, in fact, been done before as recently as 80 years ago, but I don't have time for that now, so here's an Okie song. This is Alison Krauss in Union Station.
Fine, strict minds, one crop farming, drain the green earth dry. We We lost it all, only love was left, and that was one thing that we can't buy. We were all Dust Bowl children, singing a Dust Bowl song, and the crops won't grow. Job I ever got out there was waiting on a welfare line. Once I had a dollar, once I had a dream, but now all the work it's being done by a big old machine. We're all Dust Bowl children, when fields are gone.
Because our system is not run by the people who are elected. First of all, electronic voting machines, voter fraud is rampant, but even the people who we elect don't control the levers of power. We all know who does. We know the Jewish influence, the capitalists who want to extort us to make money, and the communists who want to destroy all ethnic, religious, and racial ties are united together seeking our total extinction. So knowing all of that, how could we ever think to negotiate with them? Which is where I think we need to come in with our political party. We need to say, there is no compromise. We will not accept your 30 shekels to be able to sell out our people any longer. There is no interest in compromise. Let's even say that we would stay in the federal empire and they would give us a place for white people to live. Can we trust them? Do you really think in 50 years they wouldn't revisit that issue? An example is in Georgia. They had to change their state flag because the NAACP complained about it, having the battle flag in their flag. And the state senators all came together to say that we promise we're not going to try and push anything more. And part of that was Stone Mountain, which is basically the Confederate monument, which has General Stonewall Jackson, Jefferson Davis, and Robert E. Lee on Stone Mountain. That part of the deal was that would be enshrined forever in the Georgia Constitution. No one can ever touch it or deface it. Now we're dealing with 10 years later. The black congressmen or state senators who passed that originally are now saying, well, you know, that Stone Mountain is really racist. And we should probably maybe even just think about dismantling it. So you think, our enemy thinks generationally. Mr. Johnson was referring to what is good 500 years from now. That when we negotiate with the enemy, they still want our extinction. That is still their end goal. They're simply taking what they can piece by piece to chip away at us. We can no longer hope to negotiate or work with them. We must say firmly and throw the gauntlet at the boot of tyranny, as Governor Wallace said, that we need a homeland, that we will not work with them anymore. We're not going to negotiate with the Republicans. We're not going to play their game. We're going to advocate every single day for the creation of a state for our people, because that is the only way to guarantee our survival. And fundamentally, we need to acknowledge that, where we no longer can be hoping to get, for instance, the middle class. Because you know what? There isn't going to be a middle class very long. We're referring to people who give things up. I come out of the closet as a white nationalist. And which, you know, in previous generations was actually something to be feared to a certain extent, because you would lose your middle class lifestyle. I understand many folks here who are currently working in the system, you have something to protect. But for young folks like myself, I just received my Bachelor's of Science in History. I have a college degree.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I can't find a job above entry level. But people would say, well, okay, well, you're a white nationalist, so that makes sense. But my friends who now have even graduate degrees, who've gotten their master's in business or whatnot, guess what their job title is? Barista. You know, our system currently, there is no, you know, we've lost 11 million industrial jobs in this country. So for the blue-collar folks who can't go to college, there aren't any jobs for them there. And then, of course, even those of us who go and rack up all the college debt, we don't have any jobs that provide the lifestyle of our parents. So to a certain extent, what am I giving up? I'm advocating for my people, trying to provide a future for my children, if God willing I get married and have them. But you know, previously, there was something to lose. We don't have anything to lose any longer in this system, because they've gotten rid of all the jobs. They have guaranteed our racial suicide. You know, Pat Buchanan's book, Suicide of a Superpower, Will America Survive to 2025? Probably not. Do we really think when in 2040, as they continue moving the line back, as immigration increases, birth rate of third world immigrants increases, and we continue to abort our own, and we continue to not get married and have kids, to even maintain our population levels, do we really think this America is going to be friendly to us in 30 years when we're less than 50% of the population? Or are we facing what we saw in former Rhodesia, as we see in South Africa? Ask the white people of Haiti how multiculturalism worked out for them when they lost power. Well, we can't, because they all got hacked to death with machetes. So when we understand what we're going towards with Republicans or Democrats, or even trying to stay within the federal system, trying to maintain America, the question is, are we going to go off the cliff at 140 miles an hour or 90 miles an hour? But you know what? When your car hits the bottom after falling off the cliff, it still explodes and you die. And that's what our people are facing. So we need to say, here is a plot of land. We have our kith and our kin. We have our folk. We have our blood and our soil. This is something that we are going to fight for, and something we even need to die for. And that takes the great minds like we have in this room. We need to have the intellectual basis to be able to base our movement off of. Also, one thing I call out to anyone who's creative, we need propaganda. We need folk songs. What does the left do? You know, as my mentor Kevin Deanna told me, political knowledge is neutral. It's like a gun. If a gun sits on a table, it can sit there all day, and it's not going to do anything either good or bad. It's simply a tool. Political knowledge is something we need. The Jews and the communists won. We can all acknowledge that. We can go outside in LA and see it, how things have changed over just the last 50 years. So what is the tactics they did to be effective? Read, for instance, I would suggest Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, the book he dedicates the first page to Satan, which should tell you where his loyalties are. But he understood how to be these community organizers, these grassroots organizers. We all might make fun of Barack Obama for never having a real job in his life, but you know what? Being a community organizer got him to the White House. We need to think about what these people do to be successful. Our movement for too long has been wrapped up in what I feel is personally understandable: rage. We're losing our inheritance. Our country is literally being raped right outside our doors. That's a reason to be angry. But we need to understand and think long term. For instance, a lot of folks in our movement, well, they'll just snap and say there's an interracial couple. They'll attack them. Or they'll throw a brick through a synagogue window or things like that. Well, let's think in terms of cost versus benefit. All right, congratulations. So five of us might have just beaten up an interracial couple. We're going to be in prison for a hate crime for the next 20 years. Our club that we were just a part of is now disintegrated because it has no leadership. And the people we hurt, even if they say they even died, then how many more of them are there than we have? We don't have the numbers. We don't have the support system to be able to maintain these rash anger outbursts. We need to channel all of our aggression, as the Europeans are, into constructive political activism. We need to hit the streets, work in the communities. What does Golden Dawn do? They might fight the communists in the streets, and they might wreck them. There's a Golden Dawn shirt right there, which mad props to.
Thank you.
But what we need to see is, what's the main thing they do? People who lose their jobs, they go and they give food to them. They work with the Orthodox Church to find areas that have been especially hard hit, and they do charity. They go visit old folks and just say, how you guys doing? Like, what is going on? What are your concerns? They work within their community. our folk, even though so many of them are against us, they're still our people. They're still our blood. And we need to understand that they are not truly our enemy. They are simply confused, and much like in The Matrix, how, you know, the idea of those who are not ready yet to take the pill. But they're still our people, and we still need to care about them and save them. And we will win them not through anger, but of love of our folk. And that is what will move us forward. Where, for instance, flyers, the most effective ones I had, the White Student Union, were the old National Alliance flyers, "Love Your Race." That message struck people. There's nothing wrong with loving your race. And then, of course, when the anti-whites freak out, then white people go like, well, I understand, like, not, you know, liking, those guys probably are Nazis, but look, what's wrong with the idea of loving your race? And it started, it's planting those seeds where it's about love. And that's where I think in our culture's music, especially with a pro-white movement, we need to move towards having ballads, the love of our people, raising up our heroes, the epics that move us forward, versus being angry at the people who are doing this to us. Because they will continue doing that until we get the support of the folk. And the folk is mobilized by love of culture, by love of tradition, and love of our blood. And that's what we need to be moving towards. So in terms of how do we do this and this movement forward, we need to educate ourselves about how the enemy won. And using those tactics, outreach to the poor. You know, we talk about outreach to the middle class. I tell you what, the people who are most likely to support us are, for instance, in Baltimore, the best support I got amongst the white population were dock workers who are out of work, who are people whose factory jobs went overseas. The blue collar and the poor whites, one, they're more brave to a certain extent because they don't have anything else to lose, but they've been hurt the most by this system. So we need to focus our outreach. Of course, the middle class and the intellectuals are crucial, and they're what lead this movement. But we need to focus on those who have been hurt the most through globalism, through multiculturalism, because they're the ones who are tired and sick and hungry and poor, and they need us. We have a moral responsibility to our people to uplift them, to mobilize them, to care for them. That's what's going to move us forward. So I say outreach to the poor, looking at communist tactics in terms of community organizing, but then also having a clear goal. Harold Covington has recently come out with a mantra, which I've adopted as mine, as being probably the best one I've seen so far. If white people had a country of our own, this wouldn't be happening. Think every time you watch on the news where some Mexican illegal has raped another white girl, where some black drunk driver has driven through an intersection and killed a school kid, where every time, hell, even Barack Obama does things like give arms to al-Qaeda in Syria to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad. Every time one of those things happens, just sit there and think to yourself, if white people had a country of our own, this wouldn't be happening. Every time another factory closes to go to China because the Jewish owners wanted to make a little bit more money and your friends and family are out of work, just say to yourself, white people had a country of our own, this wouldn't be happening. And that's a message I've seen it just in my everyday activism. People respond to because they get it, because they know this isn't our country. It isn't. It hasn't been our country for a long time. I would say since the war between the states, while I am a proud Southerner, I see in the North too, where the North lost just as much as the South did, because our enemies are the ones who won. They're the ones who have been looting and pilfering us for over 150 years. And things like the Federal Reserve pushing us into fratricidal wars like the First and Second World War, those are all evil. But for a long time, I'd say over 150 years, we have not had control of our own destiny. And that's what we need to retain. So, talk to your off a little bit. But I just wanted to, again, thank you all for letting me come here. And again, every single day, we need to get up and you need to tell your neighbors, as, you know, as Mr. Johnson said about how every member a missionary in a church, I would say that for us too. Repeat the phrase over and over until people get it in every bar, bowling alley, church group you're in. Say, if white people had a country of our own, this wouldn't be happening. And that's the way to victory. So thank you guys.
Look, we all begin our respective journeys to National Socialism or Christian Identity or some other white revolutionary truth with at least a few conservative stops along the way during the early part of the journey. In my case, it was the Wallace for President campaign of 1968. Sounds to me like Matt is getting there. Let's see if we can cut the boy some slack, even if the liberal media won't, okay?
Thank you. Irish people walked all over us. And every single night when the town would come home tight, he'd invite the neighbours out with his chorus.
Come out, you black and tans, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lakes of Killeshandra.
Come tell us how you slew them old Arabs two by two, like the Zulus they had nice bows and arrows. Of how bravely you faced one with your 16-pound gun, and you frightened all the natives to the marrow.
Come out, you black and tans, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lakes of Killeshandra.
Come let us hear you tell how you slammed a brave Parnell and taught him well and truly persecuted. Where are the stares and jeers that you proudly let us hear when our heroes of 16 were executed?
Come out, you black and tans, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lakes of Killeshandra.
Oh, come out, you pretty sons, come out and fight without your guns. Show your wife how you won medals up in Derry. You murdered 16 men and you'll do the same again. So get out of here and take your bloody army.
Come out, you black and tans, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lakes of Killeshandra. Oh, come out, you black and tans, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lakes of Killeshandra.
Well, I told you at the beginning of this show that this one was going to be a little bit discombobulated. I apologize for it being so hastily slapped together, but I did believe that that entire Matt Heimbach speech was important. Hopefully, next week we'll have our usual speakers back, at least some of them. Gretchen, of course, maybe Lord Lucan, maybe Andy, who knows. But our time is up for now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.